I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Sandor Katz. His new book is called The Art of Fermentation, an in-depth exploration of essential concepts and processes from around the world. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a how-to book, a cookbook. It's kind of a history. It's kind of a manifesto. A lot of different things going into this book on fermentation. Let's start with the obvious question. What is fermentation?
Well, broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms, which would include bacteria and fungi. Types of fungi that are used in food fermentations include yeast and certain molds. But obviously, the transformative action of microorganisms does not always result in things that are delicious and that we deem appropriate to put into our mouths. In fact, most of the food that we discard precisely because of transformative action of microorganisms. So there is a certain inevitability to microbial transformations of our food, and really what the art and practice of fermentation consists of are subtle environmental manipulations to encourage the growth of certain type of organisms while discouraging the growth of other types of organisms. So you could say that fermentation, at least in its application in the realm of foods and beverages, is sort of a controlled or guided microbial transformation.
So what we don't want and what we're not talking about is cheese that's gone moldy, or milk that's curdled, or...
Well, each of those examples, cheeses that have gone moldy, some of the delicacies that are the most, celebrated culinary achievements of certain traditions involve cheeses that are deliberately moldy. Curdled is the basis of, all cheese and fermented milk products. So, certainly food can spoil and become rotten, but sometimes these processes that you're describing are actually desirable processes.
Right, but they're not the ones that have gone bad in my refrigerator are not the ones we're talking about.
Well, in relation to milk, what's most likely different about the milk in your refrigerator is pasteurized, so it's not filled with lactic acid bacteria. But milk with lactic acid bacteria that sours is the story of all fermented milk products and cheeses. A different thing happens with pasteurized milk, where you get a process that's called putrefaction, rather than a souring fermentation, which curdles the milk. Sometimes the distinctions are very fine, and I'll tell you, sometimes people want a clear black and white definition between food that's rotten and food that is fermented to perfection. And I certainly don't want to encourage people to start tasting everything that they would previously have rejected as rotten. But I think we need to understand that there's a certain culturally subjective aspect to this distinction, and I think we all can relate to it in the realm of cheeses. So, some of us love really stinky cheeses. And, once in a while I'll go to a fancy cheese store and I'll splurge and buy a chunk of stinky cheese and invite some friends over to share it with me. And some of my friends might share my passion for these kinds of flavors and aromas. And other people don't even want to be in the same room as it. And they would never for a moment consider putting that in their mouth. And to them, that's just rotten milk.
Right. And, it's also, for many people, an acquired taste and something that actually tastes good but smells not so good.
Sure, sure.
Let's talk for a moment about central to what you're saying is a fear, namely a fear of bacteria. How did this come to be a cultural norm, and what's wrong with the fear of bacteria, given that some bacteria really are pathogens?
Well, my analysis of why, we are living in a society where there is so much fear of bacteria and so much of the idea that we should just kill all bacteria and our lives would somehow be better if we could eradicate them all and live in a bacteria-free environment. The reason we have this idea is that, the first triumphs of the emerging field of microbiology 140 years ago was the identification of pathogenic organisms that were responsible for certain infectious diseases. But that was just the first bacteria that were identified. I mean, now we understand that, bacteria are our ancestors, and that, no human being, no animal, no plant, no fungus has ever lived without bacteria, nor could they. And so the scientists who count the cells of our bodies have actually come to the conclusion that the cells that we each possess, the cells that we are composed of that reflect our unique individual DNA, are outnumbered 10 to 1 by bacteria that we are host to. And these bacteria are not parasites or free riders. These bacteria actually, provide us with all sorts of, functionalities that we wouldn't otherwise have. So, they enable us to digest food effectively. They enable us to access minerals and other nutrients in the food. They actually synthesize essential nutrients for us, and they play a huge role in regulating our immune function and many other regulatory processes in our bodies. So, really, we could not survive or function effectively in this world without bacteria. So the idea of, killing off all the bacteria is really a misguided notion. And so, all these, let's say, for instance, soap products that advertise that they kill 99.9% of bacteria, that is not a desirable thing to do, because 99.9% of bacteria we can coexist with perfectly well. And in fact, that's what protects us from the relatively small number of bacteria that have the potential to, to make us sick or to create infections in our bodies.
How do the friendly bacteria prevent infection by the pathogenic bacteria?
Well, essentially what they do is they create a competitive environment that makes it difficult for the pathogens to establish themselves. Right after you take a round of antibiotics, for instance, and, wipe out much of the microflora in your body, that's when you actually end up being the most vulnerable to bacterial infections, because all of those bacteria that we're wiping out, are our primary means of defense. And, I don't mean to suggest that we should avoid antibiotic drugs at all costs. I mean, absolutely, antibiotic drugs have saved the lives of many people. But, it is really a consensus that they are wildly overprescribed in the human population. And more so than the human population, animals, especially in, confinement agriculture, are just pumped up with huge amounts of antibiotics. And the accumulation, the runoff of these antibiotics, means that in our water, we're all ingesting antibiotics every day, so it's this sort of constant exposure to antibiotics, to antibacterial cleansing products, to chlorine in water, that effectively means that all the bacteria in our bodies are under constant assault, and it's this constant chemical exposure that creates a very different situation for us in the 21st century than people ever before, in that we really need to be consciously replenishing and diversifying the population of bacteria in our guts. And one great way of doing this is with foods that have live bacterial cultures, live culture foods.
We're talking to Sandor Katz about his book, The Art of Fermentation. So what are some of those foods? What are we talking about?
Well, the live culture foods are really a subset of fermented foods. So there's all sorts of wonderful fermented foods that always get cooked before you eat them. Let's say, for instance, bread. But certain foods, are wonderful to eat raw. Yogurt is the food that people are most aware of, I think, as a live culture food. Sauerkraut and kimchi and sour pickles also have live cultures. There's a whole group of what I call sour tonic beverages that are great sources of live cultures.
Like what?
Well, I think that the most popular example would be kombucha, but all around the world there's other interesting examples. Kvass is a Russian beverage that's really wonderful and rich in live cultures. Mabi is a Caribbean beverage that is also full of living lactic acid bacteria. Tepache is a Mexican example. Just in many different regions of the world, people enjoy these lightly fermented beverages that are, sweet, a little bit sour, in some cases with, small traces of alcohol, but never enough to be really inebriating. These are really drunk as fortifying beverages.
It's interesting, one of the things that comes out in your book is the double meaning of the word culture, and those things are kind of inseparable from the perspective that you're showing us.
Yeah, sure. So, when you make yogurt, for instance, you have to add a little bit of a previous batch of yogurt, and that's how you introduce the community of bacteria that transform the milk into yogurt. And so, we call that community of bacteria, we call that a culture. The act of introducing it into the milk is culturing the milk, and then the product after the fermentation is a cultured milk or a cultured food. And so I'm just fascinated by the fact that we call these little communities of microorganisms cultures, and then we also refer to literature, language, music, art, scientific knowledge, belief systems, ritual practices, all of these things are also culture. And so culture is the totality of all that we seek to pass down from generation to generation. And then we also use the same word to describe these little communities of organisms. And, really, I think that as a group, these fermented foods, cultured foods, are critically important to culture. I mean, for one thing, I think that agriculture would make no sense without fermentation and other methods of food preservation. I mean, how could people invest all of their energy into crops that are ready at a certain moment of the year if they didn't have some techniques and some insight into how to, effectively preserve those foods to sustain them through the rest of the year. If we look around at cultures around the world, well, for one thing, I mean, I think that, I have not been able to find any examples of culinary traditions that do not incorporate some form of fermentation. And I think that there is an inevitability to this, as we spoke about at the very beginning of our conversation. Microorganisms are part of every food and will begin to transform it, whether it's in the direction of something we're going to call rotten or something that we are going to celebrate as a special food. So, all around the world, by necessity, people, figured out ways to, harness the microbial presence on foods to make foods more delicious, more stable for long-term storage, more digestible, or, in some way enhanced, rather than have the foods, simply decompose and degrade into something that is not fit to put in our mouths. So these are just critical, cultural practices. And then they also, they become part of our, ritual and religious iconography. I mean, fermented foods are just, just important everywhere.
I find it really fascinating when there are examples, and there are many of them, where cultural wisdom, in this case cultural culinary wisdom, has known things that science then puts a name to centuries later. So in other words, long before microscopes and a deep understanding of microbes and bacteria and all of that, people were fermenting foods and knew exactly what they were doing but didn't use the same didn't use the language of science.
Exactly. I mean, these are all ancient rituals that people have been performing forever, which is why it's, you know, it's kind of ironic that people in our time have projected so much fear on these processes, you know, because we have come to, because we now understand that these are microbial processes, and we have come to associate microbes primarily with disease and death. We have projected all this fear on these, you know, processes that have, you know, just been, you know, important cultural practices. You know, part of our, you know, the wisdom that has been, you know, handed down to us from our from our ancestors, and you know, really for the most part, these processes are incredibly safe. I mean, you know, the place where I recommend that most people, you know, begin an exploration of fermentation in their kitchen is with fermented vegetables, and there is no food that is safer than fermented vegetables. Fermented vegetables are safer than raw vegetables. According to the U.S. government, there has never been a single case of food poisoning reported from fermented vegetables. There are not many foods that you could say that about. You certainly couldn't say that about raw vegetables.
What's an example of fermented vegetables?
Sauerkraut.
Okay, sauerkraut, pickles, kimchi,
yeah,
which is one of my favorite foods in the world. And these are things that you can buy, but in your book, you talk a lot about how to make them. What's the advantage of making it, and what are the relative advantages of buying sauerkraut versus making your own?
Well, I mean, I would say there's no advantage to buying sauerkraut over making your own, except that it might be a little bit easier. I mean, making sauerkraut yourself is just incredibly easy. You know, you take some vegetables, you chop them up, create some surface area, lightly salt them, mix them up with your hands, and while you're mixing, just squeeze a little bit. And squeezing is going to bruise the vegetables a little bit, break down cell walls, and make them really juicy. Once the vegetables are juicy and you taste them and make sure that you've added enough salt, if you know, add any kind of seasonings you like, any kind of vegetables you like, stuff it into a jar. Stuff them really hard so that the vegetables press out all the air pockets and become submerged under liquid, under their own juices. And then ferment it for a couple of days, a couple of weeks, a couple of months. It's an extremely versatile process. You know, when you're trying it for the first time at home, you know, ferment it for a few days and then just taste a little bit of it. Then ferment it for a few more days and you'll start to see how the taste progresses. You might be one of those people who prefers it really mild, in which case you can transfer it to the fermentation slowing device that you have in your kitchen, which is your refrigerator. If you feel like it keeps on getting better tasting to you as it gets more sour, then you know, go ahead and leave it out at room temperature. You know, I have a barrel in the cellar, 55 gallon barrel full of radish kraut that I made last November, and I'm still eating out of it. So you know, really, depending on your environment, you know, these things can go for a long, long time. When I say depending on your environment, it's because the metabolism of all these fermenting organisms speeds up when the temperatures rise. So, you know, in hot summer heat, they can go a lot faster. Or if you don't have an unheated cellar, if it's, you know, if it's always in a heated home, then in the wintertime, it'll go faster rather than slowing down. So it's all a little bit, you know, situational. There's no fixed time. It depends on the temperature, but more than anything, it depends what you like. And that's one of the great benefits of making it yourself, is you can tailor it to the way you like it, or maybe the way your children or your partner like it. You know, you're not limited to sort of, you know, a single generic flavor that it's produced in.
Now, if you want to fill up your jar and you need to add a little bit of water, you have to be careful to make sure that you're either filtering your water or using water that does not have a whole lot of chlorine, because that will inhibit the fermentation process.
Yeah, I mean, typically if you're using relatively fresh vegetables and you're willing to squeeze them for a couple of minutes, you never need to add water. But in all sorts of other ferments, you do add water. And so, yes, absolutely. If you're adding water into a fermentation process, you definitely want to make sure that it has been dechlorinated. If you're on a municipal system that's chlorinated, the easiest, fastest way is to use a carbon filter or some other effective means of filtration to filter out the chlorine. Other possibilities are evaporating out the chlorine, just putting it in an open bowl or something with a lot of surface area for about 24 hours, or else just boiling the water for a little while. That will evaporate out the chlorine and then cooling it down. You do need to be aware, however, that many municipal systems are replacing chlorine with a non-volatile form called chloramine. So, if you're not sure, you can always, check with your municipal water system and find out whether they're using chloramine or chlorine.
And chloramine you can't boil off.
Right, right. You can filter it out, but you can't boil it off.
Another thing that was interesting was that people use spices in some of the things that they're fermenting, and the spices not only add flavor, but they have a practical function as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, a lot of the traditional spices that are added, say to fermented vegetables. So, in the case of kimchi, that would be hot pepper, garlic, ginger, and onions or shallots or leeks. In the case of sauerkraut, that might be juniper berries or caraway seeds or dill. But most of these spices have a kind of antifungal impact upon the fermentation system. So they, it's not that they will always prevent molds from growing, but they will really slow it down. They really inhibit the growth of molds.
What are some of the biggest problems that arise when people are learning to do fermentation? In your book, there's a lot of how-tos and then troubleshooting guides, like what happens if it turns black or if it explodes or if it smells like ammonia. I mean, they're things that are scary to even read, much less do them. But what are some of the most common ones?
Certainly surface molds are a big one. So this whole idea of getting the vegetables submerged under their own juices is really a strategy for protecting the vegetables from air and oxygen. Because if vegetables are exposed to oxygen, and probably most people listening have at some point in their lives witnessed this in their kitchen, like if you leave a vegetable on the kitchen counter, what's likely to happen to it, besides it drying out a little bit, is you start to develop molds on the surface of the vegetables. So the whole setup for fermenting vegetables is actually to protect vegetables from oxygen by getting them submerged under liquid, typically salty water, brine. And so when the vegetables are submerged, they are, protected from the free circulation of air, and molds can't grow. But unless you really, are working with a vessel that is engineered to keep air away from the surface, then there's always going to be a surface where the vegetables meet the air. And so you have the potential for surface molding. What people throughout history have done and what I do in my own practice is I scrape away the mold when it forms. It'll form much faster in the summertime than in the wintertime because, warmer temperatures just make everything go faster. So I just scrape away mold when it happens. That's one of the most worrisome things that happens to people, that makes them fearful that their experiment is a failure and that they have to throw things away. It's not a failure. It's more or less an inevitability unless you kind of engineer a way to keep oxygen away from the surface of the ferment. But it's hard to generalize about every kind of ferment, but in each section of my book, when I talk about, different types of ferments, fermenting grains, fermenting vegetables, fermenting beans, fermenting milk, fermenting meat and fish, I have troubleshooting sections in each of the chapters, addressing some of the most common, problems or confusions that people experience.
We're talking to Sandor Katz about his book, The Art of Fermentation, an in-depth exploration of essential concepts and processes from around the world. Talk about kimchi for a moment, and I'm indulging myself a little here, because I love that thing, that vegetable, so much, and have often really craved it. And I wonder, when I'm craving kimchi, I usually eat the whole jar. I don't make it, but you know, you can get these nice jars. Whether my body is just craving some of the bacteria that are in it.
Well, I mean, that's very possible, that your body is craving the bacteria, and it may be that you just, you know, love the spice combination and that, you know, beautiful rich flavor that it has. So, at one level, you could say that, you know, kimchi is, a Korean variation on the same idea that sauerkraut represents, and the main difference being, this spicing. The kimchi is generally made with lots of garlic and hot chili peppers and ginger, and either shallots or onions or leeks or scallions or one of those things, or more than one of those things. Kimchi actually has some other aspects of the process that distinguish it a little bit from the typical process of sauerkraut. But, I mean, before I get to them, I just want to say that, you know, none of these, sauerkraut and kimchi are not singular things that are the same everywhere. Sauerkraut is a German word to describe a form of, you know, fermented cabbage, sometimes mixed with other types of vegetables. That people eat, throughout Central and Northern and Eastern Europe, and it's made in a lot of variations. So, some people put juniper berries, some people put caraway seeds, some people don't put any spicing at all. I've tasted people's sauerkraut made with turmeric. I met a woman whose grandmother was from a town in Poland where they mixed mashed potatoes in with their sauerkraut. So there's, all this variation on what is sauerkraut. How long is it fermented? Is it crunchy or is it soft? How salty is it? How sour is it? How long is it fermented? These things are not uniform, and there's regional variations, and ultimately it comes down to, secret family recipes and, what your grandmother taught you about how she does it. And the same is true of kimchi. I mean, kimchi, perhaps more than any other food is, just iconic of a nation and its cultural identity, and that is Korea. But really, kimchi is made in incredible amount of variation. So there are white kimchis that have no chili peppers at all. They're not spicy hot. There are kimchis made with different kinds of fish. There are kimchis in inland mountainous regions that are made with beef stock. But a couple of things that characterize kimchi is usually this spice mix. Rather than just mixing spices with the vegetables, usually what you do is use a base of sort of a rice flour gruel or gravy. So you cook some rice flour or even some rice into a thin gruel, cool it down to body temperature, add your hot chili, often in the form of already dried flakes of hot chili rather than freshly chopped hot chilies, and your ginger and your garlic and your onions or scallions or leeks or shallots in with that. So you have this spice mix. And then meanwhile, you take your vegetables and chop them up and just soak them in salty water. You pre-soak them in a really salty brine, and this kind of it just kind of softens the vegetables. And then after they soak in a brine for, in contemporary production, usually it's just for a couple of hours. I understand that, traditionally it's sometimes been soaked for much longer periods of time, sometimes, days. Then you drain the excess water off of that and mix the spice mix in with the vegetables. Or in some cases, there are beautiful kimchis where they take whole heads of cabbages and soak them, and then they spread the spice mixture between the leaves as they sort of reassemble the whole head of cabbage. So there's just incredible variety in the world of kimchi.
Now, here's a question. There are so many different things that you can ferment. You go through them all in your book, you know, from vegetables to grains and nuts and seeds and milks and meats and so on. Does each one of these, in your view, in terms of the different bacteria that make it part of the fermentation process, do they have different health benefits? In other words, does a fermented yogurt, does a yogurt have a different health benefit than, let's say, fermented nuts and seeds?
Well, you know, each food that you ferment will really have, some unique, microbes that will develop on it. To me, the most profound benefit, particularly of these live culture foods, are the bacteria themselves. And if we're seeking to, replenish and diversify, bacteria and bacterial genetics, in our guts, then it seems to me that, eating a variety of fermented foods made from a variety of different substrates. That substrate means, what you're growing the microorganisms on. But, different foods made from different substrates will have different microbial populations. So, I think that the greatest benefit is in eating a variety of different kinds of fermented foods. Now, there are also unique micronutrients which have been identified, in relation to different fermented foods, and these are essentially metabolic byproducts of the process, of a particular type of bacteria, consuming a certain type of nutrient. But, for instance, in the case of fermented vegetables, one of the unique metabolic byproducts are compounds called isothiocyanates, which are regarded as potent anti-carcinogenic compounds. So, when we eat sauerkraut or kimchi or other forms of fermented vegetables, one of the things that we're getting are these, anti-carcinogenic compounds that can help to prevent cancers potentially. Japanese soy food called natto has gotten a huge amount of attention for a compound that's been identified that's called natto kinase. And you can really walk into any supplement store in North America and buy natto kinase. And that has been found to help to regulate blood clotting. So people who are at risk for aneurysms and other kinds of clotting disorders are taking this supplement. And there's also some research suggesting that it helps to dissolve plaque accumulation inside of blood vessels, which has therapeutic application for, anybody with, arteriosclerosis or other kinds of, heart and circulatory problems, and even for people with Alzheimer's disease. So in addition to the bacteria themselves, and in addition to the, sort of superior bioavailability of minerals and other nutrients in fermented foods, there are these unique micronutrients that are metabolic byproducts of the processes themselves.
We're talking to Sander Katz about the art of fermentation. Talk about the communities that arise from this kind of eating and this kind of thinking, and maybe from your own life.
Well, community exists in so many different levels. So, at the microbial level, microorganisms always exist in communities. The idea of, pure cultures, pure yeast, individual bacterium, that is really a human invention of the last, 150 years. And, in the natural world, microorganisms always exist in communities. And in many fermented foods, really stable communities have evolved that have, evolved dynamics that include defense strategies to protect them against random bacteria that might be present in the environment and might try to sort of move in. So the microbes themselves exist in community. If we step out of that micro level and look at human beings, as we exist in communities, food is perhaps the biggest community builder that we have. Food brings people together. And also, it takes a community to produce food. We have this myth of self-sufficiency and this, sort of idea that, people, could produce everything they need. Like nobody, no single person, no single family could produce everything that they need. You need a community so that, some people, some people can produce sauerkraut. Some people can produce beer. Some people can produce bread. I mean, none of us can do all of these things. And if we want to, regenerate local and regional food self-sufficiency, it's not about, individual or family food self-sufficiency. It's about people taking on different roles which complement one another and rebuilding community, rebuilding our local economies, by collectively, producing the things that we need.
Tell us what a day in your eating life is like. What do you have for breakfast?
I like to eat different things. I love oatmeal, and I probably dress my oatmeal up a little bit differently than most people. I grew up eating not sweet oatmeal but salty oatmeal, and in my family growing up, we always had it, as my father described it, the Litvak way, with butter and milk and salt and pepper. Nowadays, what I put in my oatmeal is peanut butter and miso and soy sauce, and I love it that way. I love to eat eggs. I've been living in the South for almost 20 years. I've learned to love grits. I love to make myself cheesy grits and eggs. I like to make omelets. I love to make, not only for breakfast, but for any meal of the day, I make these savory sourdough pancakes where I'll take my my sourdough, and sourdough is another example of a community of organisms that spontaneously develops when you moisten flour. So I just mix flour and water, and then I keep on feeding it. So I have the same sourdough going that I've been cultivating for more than a decade. But I mix a little bit of my sourdough. I'll usually grate some vegetables in it, maybe some radishes, maybe some turnips, maybe a carrot, maybe a sweet potato. Really depends what season we're in. Then I'll maybe fry up an onion, mix that into it, maybe grate a little bit of cheese into it, and then make these savory pancakes like this. I love to eat those. And then I'll usually mix a little bit of yogurt and hot sauce together as a condiment to go over it. I love condiments. My observation is that most people love to eat condiments, and if you're eating a food that is not especially inspiring on its own, condiments are really what bring it to life for people. And most condiments involve fermentation. If they're not directly fermented themselves, the way miso and soy sauce and fish sauce are, then at least they use vinegar, which is a product of fermentation, as the stabilizer for them. I really eat widely. I don't have an especially restrictive diet. I like to eat food that I know where it came from. I like to eat food right out of my garden and out of my friends' gardens. I like to eat meat sometimes. I eat a pretty varied diet. I also like to forage and eat some wild foods. I think it's really important to eat a variety of foods. I think that's in terms of our health and well-being, I think eating lots and lots of different kinds of foods is really important.
I wondered if you would like to talk about the there's so many dietary fads, and they come and go, and one of the latest that I've seen is gluten-free. Now, I have a good friend who has celiac disease, and she really can't eat gluten. But all the rest of us who don't have celiac disease, what's going on with that? Do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, so many of these foods that you're talking about in your book are loaded with gluten, and we've been eating wheat and all of these things for how many millennia? They're part of our agricultural tradition, and everybody's been healthy, and suddenly we're told we're supposed to be gluten-free. What's going on? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, I mean, throughout most of history, wheat has always been fermented by mixed cultures that included bacteria. For the last 100 years, most wheat is not fermented with bacteria. When bread is fermented, it's usually for the minimum time possible that pure yeast will rise the bread. So you just get much less of a breakdown. Actually, gluten is diminished by the bacterial fermentation of a sourdough. So, for people with extreme sensitivities, I don't think the gluten goes away entirely, but for people who are just trying to eat less gluten, like a long mixed culture fermentation, which could be just a spontaneous fermentation with what is naturally found on wheat, will diminish the gluten in the wheat. I really don't have any specific insight into why more people are becoming more sensitive to gluten. But I mean, I would say that, that is one of, a number of, big changes that are happening. I mean, there are all of these changes in human health that have not been fully explained or understood. Everything from the rise of obesity and diabetes, allergies to not only gluten but soy, lactose, other kinds of nutrients. Even some diseases that might seem to have nothing to do with food at all. I went a couple of weeks ago to a conference about autism, the autism rates are spiking in dramatic ways. Right now, 1 in 150 children that's born in the United States is being diagnosed with autism or what's called the autism spectrum. And one of the theories of what gives rise to that is basically a crisis of gut bacteria. And it's possible that many of these diseases have to do with changes in our gut bacteria or just less diversity and less vigor in our gut bacteria. I don't know that's the cause. I mean, I really I'm a person who got excited about fermented foods and learned about them. I'm definitely not a medical researcher or a scientist. But I do hear a lot of, anecdotal stories from people who feel that, their health, their ability to digest food, their children's health has been improved by incorporating these kinds of foods into their diets. And I'd also say that I've experienced that, in a highly subjective way myself.
There's also, along with food, there's this whole culture of not letting your kids play outside, not letting them get dirty, not letting them put things in their mouths, which, of course, is another way that beneficial bacteria get introduced into their systems.
Yeah, I mean, that's called the hygiene hypothesis. And it's this idea that kids just by living in more protective environments, having less opportunity to roll around in the dirt, to get physical with other kids, to get physical with different kinds of animals, just not getting the same kind of bacterial exposure as kids have historically received, and that in fact exposure to lots of different kinds of bacteria bacteria, helps us. It helps, build our microbial ecology. It helps build our immune systems. The lack of exposure, which happens in so many different ways. I mean, I just learned this statistic that, 30% of babies right now are being born by cesarean section. Well, the most important first bacterial exposure that, babies traditionally have received are the lactobacillus, that live, in the birth canal, so they're typically exposed to that. And if babies are born by cesarean section, then they, miss out on that very first exposure. If babies Wow. are not breastfed, then they miss out on, the exposure of the, bacteria that would be present on their mother's nipples. I mean, there's, just all of this exposure that a lot of children are being deprived of, and that has, repercussions on their health throughout the rest of their lives.
You have been living with HIV for a couple of decades. How are fermented foods part of your own health regimen?
Well, I mean, I eat them all the time.
Generally,
I feel really good. I mean, I certainly, my earlier book about fermentation, which is called Wild Fermentation, on the back cover, I wrote that fermented foods have been an important part of my healing. And many people misinterpreted that as meaning that I was suggesting that fermented foods were somehow a cure for AIDS. Let me be perfectly clear that, I take antiretroviral drugs every day. So I don't think it would be reasonable to say that fermented foods are a cure for AIDS. But I also, have met lots of other people on the kinds of drugs that I'm on, and many of them have digestive problems that I've never had. I can't say for sure that that is a result of eating live culture foods, but it seems like that could be, a factor in, my general well-being. I really feel wary of people making claims, that specific foods will cure specific diseases. I feel confident saying that, as a group, live culture foods have the potential to improve anyone's digestion, enable them to assimilate nutrients more effectively, stimulate their overall immune functioning, but that's not necessarily the cure to any particular disease, but
right,
that could be a benefit to, anyone living with, a long-term chronic disease, anyone facing an acute health crisis, anyone who feels like they're the healthiest specimen in the world, or anyone who's feeling the effects of aging. Any of us have the potential to have our health improved by these foods. And you know what? Trying it out, there's no risk involved. The worst that happens is you don't notice any improvement in your health.
You also talk about how working with fermented foods is actually energy efficient. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, for one thing, okay, I mean, we're living in this historical bubble where, I assume that most everyone listening to your show has a refrigerator in their kitchen, and that's wonderful. I have one also. I appreciate my refrigerator. But we have to understand that, throughout human history until, 75 years ago, nobody had a refrigerator. And, today, most people on the earth do not have a refrigerator. For us, inside that bubble of refrigeration, we can't even imagine how people could have, kept their milk and kept their meat. We could probably picture it with most fruits and vegetables. They're not quite as perishable, but human cultures around the world, through cleverness, trial and error, observation, learned techniques for effectively preserving food. And so, in a time of great energy uncertainty, where we don't know 10 or 20 years down the line, what are the costs of energy going to be? Is it going to be practical for us to continue to all have these energy sucking fermentation slowing devices in our homes, or are we going to need to turn back to some of this ancient wisdom that is our cultural legacy in order to remember how to effectively preserve our food without the benefit benefit of a refrigerator. Another way that fermentation can save energy is certain foods. I think tempeh is really a prime example of this. If you wanted to take some soybeans and cook them till they were soft enough to eat, that would take 5 or 6 hours of cooking, you know, and even then the protein in the soybeans would not be accessible. When you make tempeh, you only have to cook the beans for about a half an hour, and then the fermentation pre-digests the beans that makes them soft enough to eat and makes the protein highly available to us. And then typically the tempeh is fried for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes before it's served. So do you want to cook something for 5 hours or for 40 minutes? So the food itself becomes a strategy for fuel savings.
And you're going to be teaching here in New Mexico, is that correct?
Yes. I will be teaching near Taos at the Lama Foundation, August 22nd to 27th, as part of a larger event that they're holding called Live Here Now, Skills for Sustainable Living. And you can find information on that if you look on my website, wildfermentation.com.
Excellent. Sander Katz is author of the book, The Art of Fermentation, an in-depth exploration of essential concepts and processes from around the world. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it is my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show today.